Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
And follow your star, brave and faithful and true, and cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it
feels. Attorney Michael Hohmeyer with us for It's the Law section of Dresser After Dark. Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm terrific, Michael Ray. Thanks. You?
Oh, I'm just deciding whether or not to watch the Packers game or the president. I'm not sure here.
It's a tough call, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. There's going to be... we're doing the radio show, so we won't watch the Packers.
I get it. Okay.
Unbelievable stuff that is going on. Michael, I watch every day, and I'm not quite sure if the administration and even people on both sides of the aisle have anything to do with reality at this point.
You know, that's an open question. It really is. And it's unfortunate that we get the impression that so many of those folks are wrapped up in frivolous silliness when there are such significant, major, important issues to be dealt with. I certainly couldn't spend my day being as unproductive and out of touch with the real world as so many of those folks can and still have a practice serving my clients. It just can't work that way in the real world, but that's government for you.
Yeah, but they keep talking about the balance and nonpartisanship, and I'm quite confident that you heard Hoffa over the last couple of days.
Sadly, yes.
Yeah, sadly, absolutely. He's going to be Obama's army, and he's going to go to war. He's going to take out the Tea Party. Michael, who is the Tea Party? The Tea Party is not
us.
Go ahead.
It's us. It's average, everyday Americans of every race and creed and color, and a lot of independent thinking people and not just conservatives. I mean, the Tea Party is a spontaneous, non-political party-generated movement. The most salient political feature, I think, the most remarkable development in American politics over the last 10 years. Absolutely it is. But that the threat that you're talking about, that you're reporting on,
yeah,
is a threat against all Americans.
Absolutely. I mean, by the way, there's no question about it. And to have one American say that they're going to go to war against another American, I think the unions better take a good look at their own administration and what's running them, because I think there's basically a problem there. And the sad thing to say, Michael, if Obama does not get in, which he won't, I think there's going to be some blood on the street.
Well, I fear that as well, and you know, we're not looking to have that happen. Of course, we don't want it to happen, and we don't believe that by saying it, we're going to make it happen. That's definitely a fear, though, and you know, honestly, he hasn't done his constituents, those particular folks, really any favors. It's true, the stimulus funding was primarily federal money that went to state governments, and the states used that money basically to support the public employee unions, typically the public employee sectors, and there's a powerful argument to be made that that money only went to benefit those people. But in a broader sense, the unions have not been benefited by this administration. As a matter of fact, states like my own in California are finally about to hit the wall. They're running out of money. The stimulus is not going to be repeated. It's basically been a bust in any event, and since it can't possibly be followed up because there just isn't enough money to give, you know, the states are cutting back on public employment.
Sure. Now, Michael, I think one of the major problems that we're getting, and I really don't understand, and for the life of me, some of the people that stand up for this man, it's, you know, when I think we've talked about it, when he first came on the scene, I'm thinking, maybe some conspiracy theory here. I'm watching the economy be eroded. I'm quite confident it's going to be replaced by something else, socialism, nationalism, and whatever. And then the more he got into it, the more I began to realize he's very incompetent. He has an ideology, and he does not know what he's doing. You're going to pull all those troops out of Iraq right now. You're going to leave a few thousand troops in that country. And Iran's going to walk in there and take over the entire thing. You're going to sit back while things are going on. You're going to talk about free speech when a certain speech is controlled and somebody like Hoffa gets out there and says what Hoffa says. See, there's a problem here. And I don't think a lot of the people on the extreme left, not the left, but the extreme left, really realize what's going on. You're not a baby killer. I'm not a baby killer. I don't want to enslave anybody. I don't want to make anybody a second class citizen. But those are the tools that are being used as weapons to control people.
They are, and it's really sad to see it happen. But what's most promising about it, despite the fact that it's happening, is the fact that it's going to be rejected on a wholesale basis in the next election. There's going to be, I think, reading my tea leaves, a real political thumping that's going to take place next year. Even his friendly polls are reporting that his numbers are dropping precipitously to dangerous levels, even in their own estimation, and it's driving his supporters into apoplexy. But look, you know, what that's reflecting is that there's a consensus, that there's a huge number of Americans of all political stripes and all the other subclassifications that so many people want to break us down into, that really most Americans who are well-spirited resent being broken down into. They all want to view themselves as Americans and not hyphenations. More and more of those people are coming together and saying, you know, we may disagree on the specifics, but generally speaking, broadly speaking, from what's happened the last almost 3 years, this is not the direction we want to keep going. We want to go in a different direction. And to broadly go in that different direction together, even if when you get down to specifics, you will have people disagreeing on details. But I think this man may well have gone far, along with his cohorts when they were in charge of the Congress over the last 4 years. He may well have gone very far toward helping reform a broad consensus of America and its traditional values as far as the Constitution, the way our government was supposed to be based, and more people returning to that, seeing the need for it, recognizing the way it's been attacked and diluted. He may unwittingly be bringing about, in effect, a much welcome rebirth of a commitment to Americanism, to true Americanism, even if there will remain differences of opinion as to details.
And my goodness, when you talk about Americanism, and you know how American I am, I am so American. I will say the pledge, I will sing the national anthem. That's it. I mean, this is my country, and I'm very proud of it, and I will pledge to my flag, and I will do everything I can possibly do to keep the people within this country safe. Now, that said, one of the very sad things, Michael, that I see is the NBC not displaying the American flag because they didn't want to take sides on a cause. I don't know what that meant at all, obviously. And some of the things that we're seeing constantly, look at the I'm not a religious person per se, but where did they get off banning prayer for the 9/11 from the 9/11 memorial and for the honor that they were going to give all the people who fell there, the 3,000 some odd people? I don't get this whatsoever. You know, and if somebody wants to have a Muslim prayer, have a Muslim prayer, a Christian prayer, a Jewish prayer. But the point is where did they get off stopping this? That, you know, this country was formed in God we trust. It was a Judeo-Christian ethic. And if you look at the Ten Commandments, you'll find that underneath the Constitution lies those Ten Commandments. I don't get what people are trying to do now, because that's not the America that we created.
It's not. It's not an America that people recognize, and they don't want it. That will be the message that's sent next year, I believe, when the election results are in and the votes have been counted. People are saying, we've had enough of this silliness, we've had enough of this experiment in left-wing radicalism, we've had enough of this abandonment of first principles and the tradition that has made this country great and a haven for people and ideas from all around the world. I mean, everything that we associate with what is great about America, so much of that has been walked away from over the last 4 years. That's what is going to be rejected. That walking away, that trip away, that venture off into the twilight zone is what people are going to reject. And people are going to be saying, and they're going to be coming from a wide swath of the population, and not just Republicans and not just conservatives, but a huge percent of people from a variety of different philosophies are going to come together and say, we may disagree on details and specifics, but broadly we agree on the fact that America is exceptional, that it has a basis in a constitution, that we can have religion active in the public square without fearing it, without believing that it's going to require everyone to become a theocrat, and all this other silliness that we don't have time to indulge in anymore when the lion is, you know, no longer out in the woods somewhere, but he's at the gate. We have important issues that need to be resolved, and I don't think people have tolerance anymore for this protracted silliness.
No, and I also believe today, whatever he is saying, I've got him on the screen behind me, but whatever he is saying today, none of what he's promised has come to fruition. And I would venture to guess that most of what he's saying is more than hot air. I'll watch every once in a while, and somebody in the audience will say something, and somebody will applaud, but they'll have no idea what they're applauding at. They just know this is the time to applaud. This stuff has got to stop. He's going to be there for a year or so, and he's going to bring his money out, and he's going to make his money. I mentioned this to somebody, I think it was yesterday, that bus tour that he took, you know, the $1.3 million bus that was bought from Canada. And if you truly looked at what happened, Michael, he didn't drive from place to place. The bus was flown from place to place, and you and I paid for that.
I know, and it's really silly, and it's out of touch. And it's not what Americans appreciate, it's not what they value, and it doesn't reflect the difficult times that the majority of them find themselves in. It's really odd and off-putting to hear the press spokesman talking about how Congress is out of touch, the House of Representatives is out of touch with opinion outside the Beltway, when in fact it's not those folks who are going on these ridiculous vacation trips to these sorts of places where most Americans can't afford to go, will never be able to experience, and meanwhile, even if they were financially able to, are too busy battening down the hatches because they've got a hurricane descending on their shoulders. I mean, talk about out of touch. You know, Americans want someone who's like them, a leader, but an American, and somebody that they can identify with, someone that they can be relaxed with and trust. That guy's watching out for them, or gal is watching out for them, is watching out for the country, and is not going to do these drastic swings off into odd policies that have little in common with American history.
Well, I think, Michael, you just hit it. Little in common with American history. Now, there's some problems that we have here. There's no question about it. We always have, and we always will, to what degree or another. But to apologize for who we are and why we are, it takes our credibility away from the rest of the world. Why should the world be concerned about what we think now? Because whatever we think, we're going to apologize for in the first place. And we owe everybody a lot of money, quote unquote. If you want to bring business back, you start drilling in Alaska, you start drilling in Texas. There is a whole swath. There's an old area here that is, we've got untapped natural resources right by the Canadian border that's right here. That would create jobs. Stop sending the jobs to China and outsourcing. Bring them here. Start manufacturing. Start doing the things that we did prior to all of this outsourcing and the problems that we've gotten into. And that will put people to work. That will literally put people to work. Now, we're running out of time, but I think Rick Perry is absolutely dynamite. And what he said about Social Security's Ponzi scheme, yes, it is. The only problem with Perry was he didn't say here is a fix to the problem.
I agree, and I believe, I hope not to be proven wrong, but I believe that if he were to finish his answer and flesh out entirely his thinking, it's much more in line with the mainstream of Republican thought that is, along the lines of those people who are in the program who are 50 and older are going to continue to be covered by the program in place. But those people who are younger than age 50 who are unlikely to see a penny of Social Security, the rate we're going now anyway, need to be given other options so that they are protected by something down the road and we don't have to rely on this house of cards that is about to collapse, whether you call it a Ponzi scheme or not. And I believe it's his intention, as it is generally mainstream Republican thinking on Social Security, that it is broken, that it does need to be fixed, and while it's being fixed, you do need to protect those people who are of an age where this is the game that they can't swap it for something new because they don't have time.
Absolutely. Michael, we're out of time. A website we can find you at?
We're at www.homeierlaw.com, spelled H-O-M-E-I-E-R-L-A-W.com.
Michael Hollmeyer, we will see you next week.
Looking forward to it, and we'll talk about this speech.
Absolutely. Good night.
Good night.
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Ford Meyer's with us. He's a career coach, a speaker, and the author of Get the Job You Want Even When No One's Hiring. He's the president of Career Potential LLC. His firm helps clients take charge of their careers, create the work that they love, and earn what they deserve. Career Potential also works with leading companies that are committed to developing and retaining premium talent. He's held senior consulting positions at three of the nation's largest career service firms. And let us say, Ford, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm very happy to be here. Thanks.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here, Ford. Ford, when we're dealing with careers today, and very important, you know what the economy's like, you know what the job market is like, and people are getting to the point where they're getting frightened to death. And they seem that effort of theirs to go out and get the career they want, they seem to feel diluted. And I think it goes beyond that. You know, we have a 9% unemployment rate, but we also have a 91% of people who are working. And that's what we're not looking at. If there's a career, you can still go out and get it and you can still prep for it.
Well, I totally agree with that. In fact, I often use that exact kind of thinking process. I hear people complaining about the fact that we have a 9% unemployment rate, roughly. And I say, yeah, but that means 90% of people are still working, or 91%. And then they just stop and they look at me because they haven't thought about it that way.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that there are opportunities. It's not all gloom and doom. You see, the negativity and the bad news, which is real in many ways, it permeates the media. It sells magazines. It sells newspapers. It gets people glued to their TV. The sensationalism and the negativity, it sells. We know that. That's the American way. But I'm here to say that if people can shift the way they operate, shift the way they think, they can still get good opportunities, find great jobs, even in this very rough economy.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with that, it all starts with that magical piece of paper called the resume. Now, and I know you work with the resumes a lot. Ford, let me ask you this. Would a resume today, based on what we're looking at and going through, be different than a resume 5, 6, 10 years ago?
Yes, I think it is. First of all, I want to say that I actually don't think it starts with the resume. I think the resume is very important. It has to be great. And I'm happy to answer your questions about resumes, but I think it starts a lot sooner than that. It starts with a person's thinking process, how they're approaching this challenge, what they're doing, who they're talking to, and the kind of behavior that they're buying into. So, yes, there is a place for the resume. I'm not saying resumes are not important. They're very, very important. Now, to answer your question more specifically, the resume today has the similarity to the old resumes in the sense that it still has a summary at the top. It still has your name and address and your phone number and your email. It still has your work history and your education and so on and so forth. That's all pretty much the same. But here's where it's different. The resume today needs to really, really highlight tangible, positive results. It needs to be extremely quantified in the results that you can produce. It has to show a real track record of achievement and success. It can't just rely on your pedigree or your education or where you went to school or how many jobs you've had. That stuff doesn't sell anymore. The only thing that the employer is interested in is results. They're asking themselves, what can you do for me today? And that's the only thing they're asking themselves.
And let's take it a step farther than that. And I'm not a professional in the field, but I've owned businesses. I've been in business. I've been consulting, and I've been doing a lot of things over a lot of years now. And one of the things for that I've learned that if I'm going to come to you for a job, the one thing that's in your mind, and it's underneath all of it, how am I, Michael Ray, the person that's applying for the job, how am I going to help you increase your bottom line? Period.
And that's right.
I don't even care if I'm in the accounting office. It's all the same thing.
Yeah, and you know, I teach my clients that there's three magic words. There's profitability, there's productivity, and there's efficiency. And I'll bet that 99.9% of all hiring managers and all bosses are focused on those three words. And if you, as a candidate, can demonstrate very clearly how you can bring more profitability, productivity, and efficiency to that organization, and if you can tie your own strengths and assets and experiences to that company's problems, needs, and challenges, then you will get a job offer.
In 1961, of course, I wasn't even born yet, but in 1961, I was working for a company called Norris Thermidor, and it was in the Los Angeles area. And I was 1961, I was 20 years old, and I'm on the wheel line. And on the wheel line is that they would bring a pallet of steel wheels from automobiles, and the conveyor belt would come down, and I would take a wheel, and I'd stick it on the conveyor belt, and I did this for 8, 9, 10 hours a day. And I'm 20 years old, and I'm on mids. I'm working from like 5 to midnight every night. I have no life whatsoever. So I walked into the office to find out if I could get a job during the day. And as I walked in there, I'm talking to whoever it was, and I said, I like to go to work, you know, during the day. Swing shifts is killing me here. I got no social life. And he said, how long have you been here? I said, about a month. And after they picked themselves up from laughing, they sat back in the chair. So the key was this. I walked over to the door, put my hand on the door, and it turned around, and I said, you know, I got a mind here, and if you let me, I'm sure I can benefit this company. They said, come back tomorrow. Well, I ended up working in the chem lab, which I had no idea what I was doing until I got in there and I learned. But I became a chemical analyst. There was that part, there was that job that who thought was even there? And I think many people going in for a particular career, a job, something, there are more opportunities in there than meets the eye, because there might be something that you suit that company better for than what you went in for.
I totally agree, and that's a great illustration of sort of stepping up, you know, asking for more, asking how can I contribute at a higher level. Too many people, unfortunately, are very disengaged at work. They go in, they punch the clock, they do what they're supposed to do, and they go home. They're not thinking smart. They're not thinking, how can I do more, contribute more, make a bigger impact? How can I leave a better legacy? How can I really raise the bar? Those are the kinds of people that employers are looking for right now, not people who are just punching the clock.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. But I think one of the things that we're running into now, the culture today, there's a little bit of an entitlement culture out there, and that's not the subject matter that we want to deal with. But there are a lot of kids out there and adults going in looking for a job. Basically, you owe me, you know, kind of a mentality and attitude. And that's not what the employers are looking for. There is a mindset today that is stopping a lot of employers from hiring people. If you want a job, if you're going to be in that front office, if you're going to be that first person who greets people, don't walk in unshaven. Don't walk in with baggy pants. Don't walk in sloppy. See, and that the key is, I don't get that they don't understand that today, and that happens constantly.
So there is a cultural gap, I agree, between the people of our generation and the people younger and the people even younger than them. You know, there really is a very different mindset and a different culture and a different set of expectations. And I believe that it comes down a lot to parenting. I think it comes down a lot to the television culture we live in. You know, there's a longer conversation, obviously, but the shorthand version is I think that the parents have a huge influence over the way that their children present themselves in a professional setting.
Oh, no question. And that's the key. If you want a job, take a look at how you're going to present yourself for a job. Take a look at how you brought up. Take a look at how what you learned. What were you modeling after? And I really believe truly that the parents, and we're on track here, the parents today have a responsibility that a lot of them aren't taking because they don't even know it's there. That parent's responsibility for setting the pattern of the behavior of that child, boy or girl, man or woman, and how they're going to be later on in life and those jobs that they apply for. The way they apply for a job is the way they've been brought up, and you said it all. They were saying the same thing.
Yeah, you're right. So the resume, which is where we started, as I just want to underscore that it's still very, very important. But it's kind of just one ingredient in the whole toolkit. You know, it's not the only tool. It's just one tool. It has to be great. It has to be strong. And it really has to be compelling. But what I teach is people to think of it more as a portfolio of tools, a portfolio of skills that will really help them to become the candidate of choice.
Oh, sure. And by the way, the other thing that we might take a look at also is that 6 degrees of separation. Years ago, if I was going to apply for a job, I might have 5 or 6 people applying for that same job. Now, Ford, you got 10,000 people applying for the same job. So it's time to use the Twitter, use the Facebook, use all the social networking, and do everything you can possibly do to take a look at it, because there's a sophistication in job hunting today. And if you got a handle on it, you're one step ahead of the other 9,000 who you're up against.
You're right. The word sophisticated is very apropos. They need a more sophisticated, polished, and savvy way of managing their careers and conducting a job search. Just blanketing the world with your resume isn't going to do it. However, the resume is still going to be really, really important at the later stages when you're at the interview or when they're trying to make their final hiring decision. The resume can really make or break you. But like you said, it's a lot of the networking, it's leveraging technology, it's presenting yourself right, it's having a great portfolio of documents that you can use at the right time, at the right place, with the right person. So people need to up their skill level. They need to learn the nuanced ways, the more subtle ways of managing the job search. It's unfortunately not as easy as just sending out 100 resumes and sitting by the phone and waiting to see what happens.
No, and as a matter of fact, the other element, let's put into the mix now, is the transition from you to them, quote unquote. It's not about you that the interview is about. It's about them. What are you going to do for them? And I really
exactly right. People have a kind of a me type of mentality. You know, they walk into an interview thinking, will they hire me? How much will they pay me? When can I get started? Will I have my own office? It's completely backwards. What they should be thinking of is, where can I make the greatest contribution? Where can I make the greatest impact? Where can I really stand out because I'm going to work harder and contribute more than anybody else? It's, like you said, it's about the employer. It's not about you. They know you need a job. Otherwise, you wouldn't be sitting there. You don't have to belabor that point. What you should be asking the employer is, what are your greatest needs? How can I contribute most? How can I help most? Where is your pain? Where can I get to the heart of your issues and solve some of your problems? That's the kind of person that's going to get hired.
No, absolutely. I really believe if in high school they would start teaching how to go out and get a job, they don't.
And no, they sure don't.
No, and if they would, I think it would work really well, because you should be speaking, you personally, Ford, should be speaking at some of the high schools, some of the colleges. Mm-hmm. You know, these kids have all the wherewithal in the world, but they don't have the skill to do it. Somebody once said something to me. I was going to go do whatever, and they said, good luck, and I smiled, and I said, no. Luck has nothing to do with wish me good skill.
That's right.
Yeah, and that's it.
It has to do with skill, has to do with pride, self-esteem, discipline, work ethic. There's so many ingredients that go into success. Don't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I hate to do this. We're running out of time. Is there a website? Is there a website that you we can find you at?
Well, sure. I'll give you two websites. If people want to learn about career coaching or career development, they can go to careerpotential.com. That's careerpotential.com. I also have some really great free bonuses for your listeners. And if they want to access these three free career bonuses, they can go to careerbookbonuses.com. That's careerbookbonuses.com for some very valuable tools.
Wonderful. Hey, Ford, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Michael Ray.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care. Good night.
Bye-bye now.
And the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all. That's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall. And a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all. That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. And that's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark.
A girl to call my own. I want a dream lover.
Certified holistic health practitioner Carolyn Harrington with us. She's a holistic health and wellness expert and arguably mother of the century. In 1996, she gave birth to a newborn girl, Maddie, who was born without a spleen and suffered from severe heart deficiencies. And before reaching the age of 5, Maddie underwent 3 complex heart surgeries, 2 open heart surgeries in an attempt to regain her health. And after undergoing the complex operation, Maddie was left with strict medical limitations along with a weakened immune system, which left her vulnerable and unreceptive to ordinary and over-the-counter medications. And I think this is where it started. Carolyn, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. This is where it happened, wasn't it, when you couldn't find something to help Maddie?
That's right. The doctors did a wonderful job with her heart and helped her to regain her health with that. But there were some side effects from the surgeries that doctors just couldn't help with. There was alopecia, losing her hair, and she had psoriasis. And conventional medicine just doesn't do very well with those types of things, at least not back then. So we took her to a naturopath, and within a month, she started regaining her hair back, her psoriasis started going away, and the light bulb went off in my head. And I said, okay, there's something to this natural healing, natural alternatives. So I started researching it, and it became my passion. And from then till now, I just do as much research, and it's brought me to where I am today.
Now, by the way, with the research, what is it that you found, and I'm going to say about food, because when it really comes down to it, the doctors, and there's a place for everything, obviously, you know, allopathic medicine, chemicals, but there's also a place for something else, and that's starting to happen. And all of the medication that we have today somehow was a derivative of food.
That's correct. A lot of times the research brings you to where they take synthetically, they'll take pieces and bits of some whole food and take the active ingredient out, and that becomes the drug.
Okay, now, by the way, one of the things that you promote is honey. What is critical about honey?
Well, honey is such a wonderful substance. I mean, it's been used for medicinal purposes for about 8,000 years. So it's a tried and true method. It's stood the test of time. And any discussion about natural healing has to include honey. It's got certain properties about it. I mean, it never goes bad. I mean, they found honey from thousands of years ago that's still intact and could be used today. It's got antiviral, antibacterial properties. It is a great energy producer in the body, and it's got high antioxidant qualities in it that really make it such a unique substance.
Okay, let's break down my breakfast. Okay, you ready for this? Let's break down what's in it and tell me if I'm killing myself or I'm healthy. I start out with oatmeal, and in the oatmeal I put two large scoops of natural peanut butter in it, organic if I get it, otherwise it's natural. Inside that, I squirt honey. Over and above that, I put a tablespoon of virgin olive oil. And then I'll take a big chunk of natural or organic butter. And then what I've been doing lately is there's something called Ensure, which is it's got 350 calories in it and 13 grams of protein and all this stuff. And I throw the Ensure in there instead of cream or milk. Am I killing myself, or does it sound like I can be decent here?
That sounds like a very good breakfast to me. It seems like it covers all bases there.
Sure. Yeah, and it's all natural food.
Right. There's so much we can do with natural foods and that will promote health in our bodies. And what we're really trying to do is take the load off our bodies. When you load it with toxins, when you load it with stressors, whether it's emotional stress or food stressors or chemicals, it puts such a load on your body that it can't do the healing that it's meant to do. If you take those away by having great, healthy breakfast, then your body's allowed to do what it should be doing, that's healing your body and keeping it healthy.
So, and realistically, you know, when you get into the medical associations, et cetera, they're going to say, you know, it's against the law to say cure something. And what we really know and what we found over the years, nothing cures anything. And it doesn't matter what it is. It has to do with keeping your immune system intact. Everything that you eat, everything that you put into your body, it's either going to shore up your immune system to make everything work, or it's going to cause a disconnect so it can't work. So in essence, when it comes down to it, it's the immune system that quote-unquote does the cure. Everything we're talking about naturally is something to build that immune system to make sure that that immune system is given what it needs to do the job it has to do.
That's correct. They always talk about the barrel effect, where you've got a barrel and you're filling it with toxins and different various stressors on your body, and eventually it'll fill up to where it overflows. And that's when diseases come about, or allergies, or anything else. If you take those away, the barrel slowly empties itself, and then your immune system can do what it's meant to do. So we're really trying to take away the barriers and let the immune system stay strong and really strengthen that.
By the way, I want to go back to honey for a moment. Some of the problems that people have, how can honey help out with it?
Well, honey is antibacterial properties. It has a very low water activity level, so there's very little moisture in it, and it's got a very high acidity, and there's also enzymes in honey that produce hydrogen peroxide. So, for instance, when you have a cough, it not only soothes the throat, if you have a sore throat or a cough, it'll soothe the throat, so it gives that soothing effect, but it also has antiviral, antibacterial properties, so it'll actually help you. There's antioxidants in there. There's these phenolic acids and flavonoids that when taking as a tonic in the morning, a teaspoon of honey a day, there's research that shows if you take it for a prolonged period, it'll actually increase the antioxidant content in your blood. So that in and of itself will help your immune system stay strong by taking the oxidative stress out of your body. And then another thing that honey, I loved about honey, is that it regulates energy production. Honey has a very, everybody always hears about refined sugar, stay away from simple sugars, but honey is a natural sugar. So it has a ratio of glucose to fructose of 1:1. And everybody says, okay, big deal, what about that? Well, glucose gives you a very quick energy. So if you're an athlete and want to work out, put a little honey in your water and it'll give you a quick energy boost so you can work out. But it also has fructose in it, which gives you a sustained energy release. So it'll give you that endurance. Give it to children before school and it'll keep them going throughout the day so their energy level stays pretty consistent throughout the day.
Okay, now is there one honey that's better than another honey? What do you look for when you go out to buy honey?
Well, there's many different varieties of honey, and they're based on floral varieties. The bees that pollinate different floral varieties, whether it be clover, wildflower, orange blossom, or buckwheat, that's what produces the different types of honey. And there are studies that were done back in 2004. There was a study done at the University of Illinois that said buckwheat honey was the most antioxidant-rich honey produced in the United States. There's a honey in Australia called Manuka honey that is even higher, but it's so expensive to get here that it's cost prohibitive. But buckwheat honey is the highest antioxidant-rich honey here, and so it's going to have all these antioxidant qualities in it. So just taking that will help with that antioxidant quality in your blood. It's a richer, darker honey. The darker the honey, the better, more antioxidant, antiviral, antibacterial properties will have in it.
Now, by the way, what organic honey as opposed to natural honey, is there much difference between the two?
Well, there might be a big difference between the two, but it's very difficult to get organic honey. And here's the reason why. Bees, very hard to keep bees on an organic crop. How do you know if a bee hasn't flown off this particular crop and gotten pollinated on a different crop? So it's very hard to contain these bees on an organic crop. So, whether you can find it or not, very difficult to find. And, again, it's hard to regulate it.
Okay, and if you do find it, it may not be pure.
May not be pure. I haven't seen organic honey very often. I mean, honey in and of itself is very natural, so that's generally what you see.
Okay, now there are other things that obviously that are good for health, and one of the things that I keep seeing over and over and over again is apple cider vinegar. It is, if you can get it down, I understand it's got some really good benefits to it.
Oh, that is such a wonderful health tonic, and again, if you can get it down. I know myself, I can't get it down, just plain apple cider vinegar. But it'll actually thin mucus if you have congestion or allergies, and it's got an acidity level very similar to your stomach. So again, it's got these antibacterial, antiviral type qualities about it. And again, as an overall health tonic, it's great. And with our cough syrup that we produce with our company, we actually put apple cider vinegar in it because it's so good. So if you can mask it with some other flavors like honey or put it with other things, it's wonderful. For you, put it in a smoothie in the morning.
Okay, now let me ask you this. You said the magic thing with your products. Where do we find the products at?
Well, our products are, you can get them on our website, which is maddieshp.com, and that's Maddie's, M-A-T-Y-S-H-P. Stands for Maddie's Healthy Products. But our products are covered or they're sold in Rite Aid, which is the national retailer, and then locally, all kinds of grocery stores around the country, depending on where you are. We're pretty much in all states right now, between Kroger and Wegmans and all different various, I don't know what grocery stores are up there in Wisconsin, but I'm sure it's up there too.
Yeah, well, there's only one that I go to, which is my social life. That's Piggly Wiggly's. I get to go out there once a day.
Oh, I'm not sure if we're in Piggly Wiggly. That might be one, but we're in pretty much, we're in about 20,000 retail outlets around the country right now.
Yeah, what about Roundy's?
We are in Roundy's, yes.
Okay.
Very
all
nice.
Right. That's not far away. Piggly's is my social life. Roundy's is when I go when I want the upper crust here. Now, let's talk cayenne pepper. Can you just, it increases blood flow, I'm aware of this, but do you just sprinkle it on things to do that? How much cayenne do you really need to be effective?
Well, you know, any bit you can get would be helpful. Cayenne pepper, it increases circulation. So one of the nice things about it is that if you take it in conjunction with any other supplement, it's going to just blast that supplement around your body with that increased circulation. So again, just like the apple cider vinegar, I always tell people cayenne pepper is one of the best things you can do. It increases sweat so that you can, you know, you get rid of toxins in that way. And again, that's another ingredient that we have in one of our cough syrups. So, you know, when you have a cough, most likely you have a cold. So we're trying to load up our cough syrups with immune-boosting ingredients like apple cider vinegar, cayenne pepper, and things like that. So you're hitting the nail on right on the head there with these two ingredients.
Okay. Now, by the way, when you mentioned apple cider vinegar, you did say that, stop me if I'm wrong, that if there's a lot of phlegm, a lot of congestion, that'll clear it up.
It'll help clear it up, yes.
Oh. Is there anything that will work on that kind of congestion that people get?
Pardon me?
Is there anything that will work on phlegm and that kind of congestion when you get your throat blocked up, et cetera? What's about the best thing to take for it?
Well, you can take the cough syrup that we have, which is honey-based, because that will also help with that. It helps with sinusitis and things like that. The apple cider vinegar, our cough syrup has Celtic sea salt in it, which is a natural detoxifier, it neutralizes toxins. And the cayenne pepper, all of these types of things, again, will strengthen the immune system and really help with congestion. Coconut oil is another very good thing for strengthening that immune system and helping with congestion. So a lot of these, there's a lot you can do with that. Any antioxidant would be good.
Okay, so effectively, the cough syrup, then you can take if you don't have a cold, but if you're congested.
That's right. We have many people that are taking our cough syrup on a daily basis just as an overall health tonic. The taste is like a caramel taste. So, you know, like you said, the apple cider vinegar is so hard to take by itself. So if you put it in with other things, especially healthy things, because we've got a 9 immune-boosting ingredients in our cough syrup, people are taking it. There's a woman that was called me out of California one time, and she was an older woman and bought 5 bottles. And I thought that was kind of funny that she bought 5 bottles. So I asked her, I said, why are you buying so many? And she said, oh, I take this every day as a health tonic. So there's a lot you can do for that, and it helps with that congestion.
So basically everything is up on the website, and then there are stores. Now, does the website give you stores that it's sold at?
It does. It gives you all the national retailers around the country.
Wonderful. Okay, we're just about out of time. Let me ask you this. Is there a question that I did not ask you that I should have that would have brought information up that we, the audience, need to hear? I think you have some extremely important things, and more people should be aware of it.
Well, one of the things that I like to mention, and getting back to the honey, is about the wound healing, and that is so fascinating that honey is actually better for wounds than some over-the-counter things. There's anti-resistant bacteria, the MRSA bacteria, that flesh-eating bacteria. They found that honey actually helps with that. So honey has so many different qualities, and there's so much information out there about home remedies and things you can do with honey that it's worth really checking out. And I encourage anybody to empower themselves with their lives to go and check out all these different alternatives.
Wonderful. Carolyn, let me ask you this, please, one more time with your website, and then we're just about done.
Our website is MattysHP.com. Matty's, M-A-T-Y-S-H-P. That stands for Matty's Healthy Products. And there you can find our products and different health information and different reasons to go all natural.
Wonderful. Hey, Carolyn, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I really appreciated your time.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, for having me. It's a pleasure.
Okay, good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.
That's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all. That's all. Say it's me that you'll adore. Yeah, it's me that you'll adore. For now and evermore. That's all.
Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms and know the magic of her charms. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. So true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do till all my lover's dreams come true.
Richard Iyer with us. He's the co-author of The Entitlement Trap: How to Rescue Your Child with a New Family System of Choosing, Earning, and Ownership. Richard and Linda Iyer are among the most popular speakers in the world on parenting and families. Their clients and audiences range from the Young President's Organization, major corporations, associations, to a worldwide array of school, civic, church, and community groups. The authors of numerous books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Teaching Your Children Values, as well as many others. And let us say, Richard, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, the entitlement trap, this entitlement stuff, Richard, I think came within the last 7 or 8 years, I think, at the most. as the culture transitioned and the different thought patterns were going through this country, entitlement happened. And today, if you're not very careful and if you don't have the wherewithal to be able to handle your kids, if you chastise them the night before when you get up for breakfast in the morning, they'll be sitting there with their attorney.
Well, it really is a recent phenomenon, Michael. You're right on to say that. In fact, you know, we've been around speaking to parents for 20 years or more, and up until about maybe 8 or 9 years ago, you really didn't hear parents using the word entitlement to describe their problem. You'd get a parent saying, well, my kids are a little spoiled or this or that, but we have a poll result now just from last week where over 50% of American parents say that the entitlement attitudes of their kids is their biggest single parenting challenge. Just imagine that. That's outpolling things like peer pressure or substance abuse or pornography. Parents are just, they just don't know what to do. And the sad thing is they've really created the problem themselves by giving their kids way too much stuff and not requiring their kids to work or to earn or to save or any of these other things that we all know are part of becoming financially savvy and being economically sound. We've failed to teach these things to our kids.
Richard, there's another point to look at here. I think and I'm not a parent today, thank goodness, knock on wood. I think I'd be in jail. but parents today, they're hamstrung. They've got their hands tied behind them. You know, in the old days, and I'm not saying whack a kid, that's not where I'm at with it, but in the old days, you stepped out of line, your mom or dad whacked you in a rear end, and you didn't do it again because there was consequence to that. Today, you can go to jail for that, and those kids know it also. So I think the parents have to walk a very thin line of what's acceptable and what's not acceptable, not in the house, but from the outside in. And I think that's a problem.
Yeah, you're right, Michael. Let me tell you a story that really gets at the issue, I think. And this in a way, this really led to the book. Several years ago, one of my sons came in after school. He's 9 years old, and he's missing his shoe. And I'm like, son, where's your shoe? Well, Dad, you know, the snow's melting, the water's in the ditch. I needed a boat. The shoe worked great. It was just going down the ditch. Well, where is the shoe, son? Well, it went under the road and never came out. Do you know how much that shoe cost? You know, the typical parental response. And this son, Josh is his name, looked up at me and he said, Dad, it was actually your shoe because you bought it and you probably will buy me another one now, won't you? Well, I mean, speaking of the urge to smack a kid, I felt it right then. But once I got over that, I realized he had just taught me something very profound, Michael. He did not perceive ownership of the shoe, nor did he perceive ownership of any of his toys or any of his clothes. Why should he? He didn't buy them. He didn't give up anything for them. He didn't earn them. He didn't save for them. He didn't wait for them. And I realized it's really much simpler than we sometimes make it. When people don't own things, they don't take care of them. You can see that among adults. An adult who lives in an apartment, and then he buys the apartment. It's now a condominium. He owns it. Suddenly he paints it. He takes care of it. He puts a flower box in the window. And that's how kids are, too. If they don't perceive ownership of things, they just don't take care of them. They feel entitled. They feel like, hey, give me some more stuff. I deserve to have everything my friend has.
And two areas of consideration also, Richard. There was a person I know who had an 18-year-old daughter, and I happened to be standing in her house one day. It's a few years back. And I remember she said something to her daughter, and her daughter looked at her, and she said, and her daughter was still in high school. She was living at home. And her daughter looked at her and said, well, I'm 18 years old. It's my body. And I stood there, and I looked at the kid, and I had a decent rapport with the kid, so I could talk to her. And I looked at her and I said, I don't think so. As long as you're living in your mother's home, it's her body. When you move and you leave, it's your body. And I think she finally got that after she left, didn't have enough money to live and put expenses together, you know, just running home and mom help. But at the same, the point here is that they have no respect because what does mom and dad know?
Right.
You know, they've got technology now. They've got Twitter. They've got all of these things they can text each other back and forth with. And if you don't know that stuff, you know nothing.
Well, see, I mean, you're getting into the heart of the issue. Kids are, they're kind of rock stars in their own world today. They've got a Twitter account. They've got a Facebook page. You know, they've got this little image they're cultivating amongst their friends. And it's like the parents are working for the kids. I mean, you go back a few generations, kids actually used to work for parents. I mean, they used to help us on the farm, right? Boy, that has turned entirely 180 degrees. And I talk to parents all the time who are saying, you know, I'm just so worried that my son doesn't like me. He doesn't think I'm a good mom. I'm not giving him as much as his friend's mother gives him. And it's almost pathetic sometimes. You want to grab these parents and say, you know, your kids don't need a friend. They need a parent, and they need a parent who will teach them how to work and how to save and how to budget. And see, the thing we've tried to do in this book, Michael, is the first part of it is all about finances. It's all about setting up a family economy where instead of an allowance, by the way, we are really on a crusade against, think about the word allowance in the first place. It's a welfare term. It's like, here, I allow you to use some of my money. Here, Josh, I allow you to use the shoes I bought, you know. Instead, we suggest a family set up a little economy where there's a family bank, little chest with a lock on it. There's money in there. Kids have certain things they have to do each week. They keep track of them, and on Saturday, it's payday. And how much they get is according to how much they've earned. Even a kid 7-year-old, in fact, 7, 8, 9, 10-year-olds are the perfect age to start this with because they're actually flattered by responsibility. Hey, son, you can earn this money. It's your money. You can buy your own stuff. You don't have to ask me for things anymore. You can have a checkbook that writes out checks on the family bank. So the whole first part of the book is finances. But then the second half of the book essentially says, hey, if you can give them ownership of their clothes and their toys and their money, how about giving them ownership of their own body, of their own decisions, of their own values, of their own choices? Even their own conflicts. How about letting them work their own conflicts out instead of bailing them out every time?
You know, when we really come down to it, you mentioned something early on. I want to expand on a little bit about the role of a parent. If you go all the way back to this agrarian society that we had, you know, the farms, the ranches, the original responsibility was, you know, mom taught the girls how to cook and clean up, and dad taught the kids how to go out, and the boys how to go out, and then they taught them how to shoot, and they taught them how to go out and hunt, and so on and so forth.
That's right.
Then we had the advent of the train. Now, all of a sudden, with the train, the kids were getting farther and farther away from home. The kids depended upon mom and dad to teach them about life and how to survive. And then the train came, the car came, the rest of it. And then pretty soon you had the schools and you had the government who are now becoming mom and dad. And the kids are now depending upon the government, the schools, the rest of it, quote unquote, for survival. And somewhere
yeah,
the transition
really
got lost. Yeah.
Well, and you see, now I'm not, I don't want anyone to think I'm advocating, Michael, that we go back to, you know, 100 years and we go back to Leave It to Beaver or whatever. But what I do think you're right on when you say is that things are evolving and that we need to understand that that kids need responsibility as much today as they did back on the farm. I actually had a guy come up after a speech I gave the other day, and he said, Mr. Iyer, you have really convinced me. I'm going to sell my city, my house in the city, and I'm going to go buy a farm, and I'm going to teach my kids responsibility with chickens and eggs and so on. I go, wait a minute. That's not what I'm saying here. What I'm telling you is you can use money. Think about this. Money is actually a perfect raw material to teach responsibility with. It's measurable. You can count it. You can save it. If you learn how to earn money, how to save it, how to budget it, that's a pretty good definition of responsibility. The problem is we don't use money that way with our kids. We hand it to them and we give it to them instead of setting up a system where they can earn it. And so we fail to teach them these basic lessons of responsibility, which are actually not that difficult to learn if we set up the right system.
But also there's another step, Richard. That step is called consequence. there is no consequence for anybody's actions anymore. If you,
well, that's the point. Yeah,
yeah,
that's my point. See, and you start that. Our premise is you begin that with money. A kid fails to earn the money for the week. He does not get paid that week. He wants to go to the movies with his friends. He has no money. He doesn't go. That's his consequence. Or he earns the money. He runs out and buys a $120 pair of jeans, and now he's out of money for the weekend. That's tough. That's the consequence, and he learns it. And the beauty of it is, if he's 10, 11, 12 years old, the consequence is very inexpensive. The problem we've got today, Michael, is kids go off to college. They're 18 years old. They've never learned how to handle money. They've never learned how to earn money or save money. First thing they find in their dorm room mailbox is, guess what? Pre-approved credit cards. Yeah. And now you've got an expensive lesson on your hand, parents, and it's going to cost you.
Yeah, no question about it, because they're going to be hounded for the rest of their lives until they pay it. I know somebody right now, I guess it was 15, 18 years ago, she took out a student loan for $3,000, I think it was. And now she owes $17,000, $18,000 because of the interest and everything else that was involved with it.
Now, contrast that, Michael, with a kid who starts when he's young in his home, learning to earn, learning to save. Let's say that your family bank pays interest. And let's say that kids know that the money they leave in the bank will grow and that money's earmarked for college. We have so many letters from families who've done this, and now they go off to school, and maybe they've got a deal. They've negotiated with the kid, and maybe the kid knows he's going to pay 20% of his own tuition. So he saved the money. He perceives it as his. He earned that money. He writes out a check, a real check now, not a family bank check anymore. He pays part of his tuition, and suddenly, guess what? That kid now starts to feel ownership of his own education. We got kids going to college today all over this country who, if you were to say to them, how much is your tuition, they wouldn't have a clue. They never even see the bill. That dad pays it or mom pays it, and they're just partying. They're just there to have a good time. They don't feel ownership in their education.
But by the way, there's also a welfare mentality that's going on too. This is an extreme example. There's two incidences that I caught, but one of them especially, there was a young man on the East Coast, I think it was in New York, that was killed in some kind of an accident. He was 26, 27 years old, something along that. Now, this young man had, and this was in the papers, this young man had 6 girls and 3 boys, babies. Each one of those kids were getting $1,340 a month from welfare.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so why work?
You know, that particular problem, we lived in England for 4 years, and it is just terrible there, because you run into a lot, and the kids are very open about it. You'll run into these 16-year-olds who will say, you know, I think I'm going to have a baby, because then I'll get more money from the government. They're planning to go find some guy and conceive a child so they can get into the welfare system, if you can imagine that.
Yeah, no, I got it loud and clear. Loud and clear.
Luckily, we don't. Most of us don't face that. But what virtually every parent in America faces is kids who are, the peer pressure now is not so. I mean, it's still to do things that they probably shouldn't do, but it's also to have things that they probably shouldn't have. And you know, a lot of parents are pretty chicken, Michael. The kids come home and say, "Hey, Mom, my cell phone is 4 months old. The kids are laughing at me. I need the new phone." And the parent caves in and buys it for him. Part of the problem is we work more now than we ever used to, and both parents work, and, you know, we make up for it by giving kids more stuff without realizing that we're taking away from them self-esteem, self-initiative, self-motivation, all these things that kids learn when they actually have to begin to earn their own way in life.
No question. Now, by the way, we're starting to run out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. The name of the book is The Entitlement Trap. The name of the website is just drop the. It's just entitlementtrap.com. I tell you one thing I love about this. The book's just been out 2 days, and I only saw it for the first time about a week ago, Michael, The Entitlement Trap. And what I like, they found, Penguin Publishers, found the most spoiled-looking little bratty kid you have ever seen.
I've got a copy. That's enough to make me want to read the book just to see how I can fix her.
You look at that, and you say, "Man, I do not want this child. I better do all I can to avoid getting this child."
Oh, and there's so many of them out there. Hey, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. I've really appreciated your time. I think that your strategy is just spot on.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's been great to be with you.
Take care. Good night.
Good night.
Some of these days, you're gonna miss me, baby. Some of these days, you'll feel so lonely. You're gonna miss my hugging, you miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. You're gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in wrong, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so quick, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Sought-after speaker Howard Kay with us. He's authored the book, You Were Born Healthy, Choose to Stay That Way, Discover the 7 Essential Secrets for Lifelong Health and Wellness. He's a wellness coach and he's a consultant. And let us say hi, Howard. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Oh, wonderful. I'm looking at San Fernando Valley here, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, wonderful.
I'm in Tarzana.
Oh, okay. I lived in the San Fernando Valley for years and years and years, and I moved out of there, and I think it was like 1983, but I was in the Encino area.
Well, right next door.
Way back, way back. Okay, let me ask you this. You were born healthy, choose to stay that way. The 7 Essential Secrets for Lifelong Health and Wellness. Howard, what caused you to take a look at this subject matter? What was it that caused you to see health the way you see it now?
Well, I had a lifelong lesson. I ended up with both a heart attack and a stroke, and it made me stop and wonder what I did wrong, where I went wrong, what I didn't do, what I did do, and I had to reevaluate everything and did a lot of studying. But I survived both of them. I'm still fighting back, and I've become an expert. I'm known as America's Wellness Coach, but it was through that incident. I've been interested in health and wellness for about 30 years.
Now, the heart disease, the heart attack that you had, what brought it on? Was it the normal business stress? Was it things like that, or was it something else?
Well, it was a combination of things. Like anything, nothing is happening just for the sake of happening. Health is a process, and it accumulates. And it was basically, if I listened to my own advice and did the seven essentials, I could have avoided it. Probably the number one thing I did wrong was I knew I had come from a family of heart disease. I had high cholesterol, and I was getting monitored by a doctor, but I didn't really take it too seriously. I didn't believe much in doctors at the time, so I didn't continue it, and I should have. I brought it down a little bit. I took off some weight. I was drinking more water, but I wasn't doing all the seven essentials, and I brought it on myself.
Now, let me ask you this.
One of the key parts of my book, the title of the book is Choose to Stay That Way. What I found right and left was that health is a choice, and our health is a choice. And I made a lot of wrong choices. I look back when I was younger. I was an athlete. I was on the track team. I was very fast. And I look back at those days and realize that never once did I look at my mortality or did I ever think about having a heart attack, and I should have.
Now, by the way, when we talk about, well, you mentioned you ran track, you were an athlete. Exercise. And notice you're talking about exercise myths that you can't afford to ignore if you want to keep your health. Now, most people, go ahead.
Well, I basically don't use the word exercise a lot. I get shock value from people by saying that you don't have to exercise to be healthy. As most young authors, the first time you're an author, you're asked the same question by everybody, and that's, who's your target audience? And I thought I answered as best as I could, but I was wrong. I thought that everybody would like to be healthier. And so I said, everybody, and they said, no, it needs to be a niche market. And I did my own survey and found that 5 out of 10 people, when you ask them if they wanted to be healthier, would say, no, thank you. I'm already as healthy as I can be. I haven't been given a life sentence, meaning they weren't diagnosed with cancer or anything like that. And in their mind, they knew they'd have to get in shape to be healthy, and they knew that that was some form of exercise. And to them, to the average American, exercise was hard work, and they didn't want to do hard work. So they would say, no, thank you. So in my book, I basically say you don't have to do any exercise, and you don't. It's sort of a play on words. You need to keep the body in motion. The air's in motion, our blood's in motion, our body's in motion, the earth's in motion, and you need to keep the body in motion to increase blood flow throughout the body. And one of the best ways of doing that, although there are many, they don't take a lot of work, they're not exercise, they're keeping the body in motion, and the best way to do that is by walking.
Oh, okay. But how long does somebody walk? Do you walk a mile? Do you walk 5 miles?
I personally walk a mile and a half for 30 minutes 5 days a week on a treadmill. Off a treadmill is better, at least 30 minutes a day. Walking doesn't take a lot of effort, but it takes some effort. The person who sits on the couch and wants to sit on the couch and eat potato chips and watch TV is not a candidate for better health. You have to take some action, and you have to keep the body in motion.
Now, by the way, is it ever too late to do this? When I say too late?
Never.
Okay.
Never.
You get a guy who's maybe 60-some-odd years old and
never too late. One of the things we're finding late as you go, it becomes later and later, but somewhere in the range of 90% of the population of the United States is clinically dehydrated. They're not getting enough water. And the sooner you start drinking enough water, the sooner you will be better and feel better and be healthier. Something in the range of 90% of the body is water, and yet Americans typically do not drink enough water.
You know, that's true. And that it's very true that we, most of us, don't drink enough water. Now, the other thing we're dealing with is the kind of food that you eat. You're talking about reducing acid in your diet. When you talk about acid, what is acid, and what kind of foods do you find it in?
Well, it's a combination. You want to keep the body alkaline, not acid. And most people, when they do drink water, they're drinking bottled water or tap water, both of which are heavily acid. Everybody has a pH scale in their body that goes from 0 to 14. 0 is the ultimate in acidity, and 14 is the ultimate in alkalinity. You don't want to be at either extreme. Everything in moderation, and you want the body to be in homeostasis, which means balanced. When you were born, you were born at 7.356. And then as life presents itself to us, we become more and more acid until most Americans are now currently acid. So the answer to your question is, number one, they need to drink more water, but they have to drink alkaline water, not acid water. It's critical that people get alkaline and stay away from acidity. Most disease happens when the body's acid. As an example, cancer doesn't exist in an alkaline environment, yet everybody who has cancer is acid. Those that are acid doesn't mean that they're having or going to have cancer, but they're more prone and more susceptible to it. So you want to get the body alkaline, and the key way is by drinking alkaline water. Nutrition is one of the 7 points. And a lot of different foods are acid or alkaline, but what they are outside doesn't mean what they will be inside the body. So you need to do some research and find out and balance the body to make sure that you're constantly keeping track of, usually with litmus paper, to find out whether you're alkaline or acid. And the best way besides drinking water is eating your water. And what I mean by that is you want to eat more vegetables and fruits, but you especially want to take fruits like watermelon, like cantaloupe, like beets, like celery, food that has a lot of water content in it, and eat those so you get more water, number one, but you also get more fiber, and you're on the alkaline side of things. But still, you want to check your alkaline at least once a week, if not some more often, and you do that by litmus paper.
Now, what about sugars? You know, we've heard so many bad things about sugars. How dangerous is sugar for you?
Well, sugar can lead to diabetes, which is another breakdown of the immune system. So you want to stay away from sugar as much as possible. But nobody's perfect, and you don't want to and don't have to be perfect. Now, sugar, as bad as it may be, is much better for you than artificial sweeteners. People think they're going to lose weight by taking artificial sweeteners. The main one out there is aspartame, which is part of Diet Cokes and Diet Pepsis. Aspartame is literally a poison, and while people don't die from drinking it immediately, it's an accumulative effect and will kill you. So you want to stay away from aspartame at any expense. It will break down your immune system. It is a poison.
Okay, so when we are dealing with a lot of foods, now, by the way, let me move to another focus here. Will the book break down the good foods and the bad foods?
Some of them, yes. You need to do some of your own research because there's no such thing as a good food or a bad food. Like I say, some foods on the outside are acid, but when you take them into the body, they become alkaline. So you need to do your own research on what kind of foods. Specifically, though, you want to take in more vegetables and more fruit, especially beets, which are very good for the immune system and for the artery system, celery, which is fiber, cantaloupe, watermelon, anything that has water in it. But it will touch upon some foods, but not all foods. The basic thing is that they have to see how the food reacts in their body, whether it turns acid or alkaline, irrespective of how it was before they ate it.
Okay, and then you can do that with what? You mentioned, what was the kind of paper that you use?
Litmus paper tests your alkalinity. You want to be between 7.2 and 7.4. You were born at 7.365, so you're a little over neutral. From 0 to 14, 7 is right in the middle, is neutral. Very few people can be right at 7 and stay there. It's a range, and you're never going to be perfect. So you want to be about 7.2. The main way is to eat fruits and vegetables, and the main and most important way to get the body alkaline is to drink warm water.
Okay, so just load yourself with water every day. Now, one other thing.
I don't want to say load. I don't want to get too technical, but take whatever your body weight is and divide by two. So just for the sake of argument, assume you're 200 pounds. You divide that by two, you get 100, and you convert it to ounces. You need 100 ounces of water per day spread out through the day of alkaline water. You don't want to take acid water in if you can help it. Now, again, nobody's perfect, and we're not perfect, and we're not aiming towards perfection, but you want to be between 7.2 and 7.4 alkalinity, which is a little over the middle ground of it, but it's going to keep the body alkaline. And when the body is alkaline, disease can't affect the body and can't clog the blood's arteries.
By the way, Howard, we're starting to run out of time now. Do you have a website again we can find you at?
Yes, I'm at www.youwereborn healthy.com.
Wonderful. Hey, Howard, thank you so much. Go ahead.
Oh, if your listeners want to go to youwereborn healthy.book.com, they can download free a bunch of quotes on wellness and on health directly.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you for your time you spent with us tonight. I think this is great stuff.
My pleasure. I'm more than happy to help in any way I can. I want to educate people on heart attacks.
Thanks. Good night.
You fly down that good night. On the chance that you'll meet, and you meet
not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I've had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so. but that was once upon a time.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dyke Drummond with us, MD, spent 15 years as a family physician before becoming an entrepreneur, trainer, and a life and business coach. His companies have taught leadership and facilitation skills to the U.S. military, commercial real estate investing. He was a trainer with T. Harv Eker and Peak Potential Systems, and he's an experienced international speaker and the creator of, listen to it, the 3-hour midlife crisis life change process. And let us say, Dyke, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael Ray. Thanks for the opportunity. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's define what a midlife crisis is first, and then we can maneuver from there.
Well, it may be easier to define what it isn't. Let me ask you just a quick question. Sure. If I just simply out of the blue say the word midlife crisis, what's the first thing that you think of?
Oh, alcohol.
Yeah, alcohol. Or how about if it's a sports car, what color is it?
Okay, it's red.
Yeah, right. So there's a Hollywood stereotype and a cliche of the guy my age, 50-something, who divorces his wife, buys a red sports car, and starts behaving badly. But that's just something that sells movie tickets. That's what a midlife crisis is not. However, that negative stereotype stops a lot of people from admitting that they may be at the cusp of a real midlife crisis, which is this. You're simply becoming aware of the fact that your life is on a path. You do certain things every day and maybe have done it for decades that get you a certain result. And you're becoming aware that there are other paths available that would get you a different result. You're aware that you have the ability to make a decision to live your life in a different and more fulfilling way.
Okay, so what we're really saying here, and stop me if I'm wrong, Dyke, but in all seriousness, I was playing about the alcohol and the red car. But when we really deal with it, when you talk about midlife crisis, is when your life has been going a particular way, a certain direction, it falls apart on you. And now you've got to experience some kind of identification, a new way to say this is who I am. And there's too many people who go out there and they get in trouble in that short period of time until they get themselves back and grounded again.
Yeah, there's actually a fundamental mistake that red sports car driver is making. And imagine this. Imagine you get to a point in your life where there's something missing. Let's imagine it's a hole in your chest. And what I'm saying is a functional midlife crisis, which is what I teach people to do, it's a shortcut to living the life you deserve. A functional midlife crisis is where you take that hole in your chest and you fill it with things that are meaningful and fulfilling and that you're passionate about. But it's really easy to mistake those things for things that are pleasurable, like a red sports car and young women. That's pleasure. You can pour as much pleasure as you want in that hole, and it's not going to fill it. So what I call that red Ferrari syndrome is basically a midlife catastrophe, and it's one of the three major mistakes you can make if you're looking to change your life in midlife.
So what we're really saying here is the difference between accidental or an intentional result in the way your life is going to turn out. If you go into the crisis mode and you become somebody who you completely and totally aren't, then it's accidental. You don't know where you're going to end up. But if you're following what you have to say, life all of a sudden becomes intentional and you maneuver your way through it because you know what you're doing and you know what's behind the actions that you take.
Well, and it isn't actually even following what I say. What I teach people to do is in my experience, and you may have had this experience too, there are a lot of people out there that have something that sounds disastrous happening to them in their life. They lose a job, they lose a spouse, they get cancer or something like that. And what it does is it throws them into a pattern of looking inside themselves for what they really want. And they begin to change their life in a way that 2 years after that negative event, they say, losing my job was the best thing that ever happened to me. Getting cancer was the best thing that ever happened to me because it made me look inside at what I want my legacy to be at in the time that I have left. So the answer is, one of the keys is, when you're asking questions, is this all there is about my life? The answers are actually within. It's within you that you look to find the answers that are already there.
Okay, let me restate the way I said it when I said follow what you say, or we can say it like going through the process that you've laid out to recognize the who you are and what you really want.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And I think what happens with so many people, Dyke, they don't have the roadmap to get there. They don't have the step 1, 2, 3, and 4. They get in the middle of the crisis and they just have no concept which way to turn because it's all brand new now and it's a road they've never traveled. And it's not what they don't know. It's what they don't know they don't know that gets them in trouble.
Right. And they don't teach this stuff in school.
I wish they would.
Well, and a lot of time what's happening, too, is that in order to figure out what you want in your life, that goes opposite to the way we're actually wired. It goes opposite to the way that our brains are wired. As a physician, I know that what our brain is wired to do always is be on the lookout for danger and things that are problems and the bad things in our life and attempt to avoid them. In fact, when you have a problem in your life, that actually marks an unfulfilled dream, and you have to actually turn away from the problem. Don't try and solve the problem. Einstein said, no problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness where it was created. We focus on problems, we focus on problem solving, when actually if you looked at the dream in the background and set yourself a goal to live that dream more fully, the problem would simply disappear. And that's one of the things that I teach.
And it's also think thoughts that you didn't think you could think. There's that old adage about thinking inside the box, you know, and most of us think inside the box. We've got the same thoughts. We mix them up a little bit. They come out a little different, but they're all the same. The true definition of thinking outside the box is thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. Even though that's a mouthful, that's critically where it's at. And most people didn't think they could think it. And the moment that they know that they can and they get permission, and that's really what this boils down to, somebody getting permission to have a decent life and to be okay. Because if they're going to go into crisis and if they're going to have the problems, they're going to go a little off because of the definition of what somebody else taught them life was. And I think that in and of itself is most of the problems that most people have. I'm living life based on what you tell me my life is like, as opposed to what's missing inside of me, and I don't know how to get.
Yeah, and at a certain point in all of our lives, typically in our 40s, 50s, and 60s, we've had plenty of experience of life and what we like and what we've liked and what we haven't liked, what has felt fulfilling and meaningful to us and what hasn't. And that's when we get to look over our own life experience and make a decision for ourselves of what it is that you're really looking for in the time that you have left and create that for yourself. And like you said, thinking thoughts you didn't know that you could think, that's around that concept of a comfort zone. What's obvious when I say it but isn't so obvious when you're living it is, if you have a full life and there's something missing, that something that's missing in your life is automatically outside your comfort zone. You have to think new thoughts and do new things in order to bring that into your reality. So the midlife crisis is simply a decision point where you decide to make a change, because the word crisis simply means decision. And then there's the whole process of putting a new action plan into your life and making it stick, so that your midlife crisis does not end up like so many New Year's resolutions. You know, 95% of the time they fail. Once you make a decision about something important like this, it really is important that it succeeds. So, again, that's one of the services that I offer, is support and coaching to folks that make the decision to go for something meaningful.
Yeah, and then they step beyond that, better unhappy than unsure. You know, people are frightened to death to step out of that comfort zone because they don't know what's out there. And realistically, what's out there is a better you. I think everything that happens in life, whether it's cancer, whether you lose a relationship, somebody dies, whatever the case is, there is a gift in it. There's a blessing in it one way or the other, because if you can move your way through it, you can see what it is at the end of the rainbow. It's probably the best thing that ever could have happened to you, because it would have been that stimulus that created the change you needed to step up to the life that you truly were meant to be in.
Right. And my own personal experience is that, and the reason that I do this work is because I actually have had two major midlife crises myself, made two of the three mistakes you can make. In the first one, I was a family practice doctor by training, and it was actually my mother's dream, not mine. So at the age of 40, I walked away from my medical career and shaved my head and gave up the six-figure salary and had to recreate myself. And then just 2 years ago, my 24-year marriage came to an end, and all of a sudden, the house I raised my family in is gone, and I'm living in an apartment with rented furniture. So I have a personal experience of being basically wiped clean and having to reinvent myself completely. And, yeah, even though those things seem so harsh at the time, they create space for a person to build something new based on what they want. And that's that magic moment to seize. You have the opportunity here to actually take the life you did have and create a new version that's even more closely tied to who you really are.
And it's coming from a place of quote-unquote nothing, which is a scary place for most people to be. But if you come from a no-thing, a nothing place, then all of a sudden you're creating. You're not just expanding on what you have. This is a whole creation of something brand new, and you put together a brand new foundation of for who you want to be, why you want to be, and where you want to go. And I think it's Alcoholics Anonymous. I've talked to a lot of people who have gone through that, and they said most of the people who were there, they don't start to turn around until they're at the absolute bottom and there's no farther they can go. And once they're at that place, then they start to move up again if they decide they want to make that move up. But it's starting from nothing. Nothing mean equals creation. Anything else you have is nothing more than it's just an expansion of what you already had.
Yeah, there is one of my mentors used to say that human beings are either creating or they're consuming. You're either growing or you're coasting, and that our true purpose is to be consistently growing more and more into who we really are. And these life events that come along and wipe us out, as long as you've got support and you don't start circling the drain like the red Ferrari person does,
sure.
It can really be an amazing time in your life. And I've been there twice, which is why along the way I learned that I have a gift for helping people in those kinds of situations.
But you couldn't have helped them unless you'd have been there. I'm going back to AA again. You know, the best person to work with somebody who's going through those problems is somebody who's been there and done that. It's not just academic. It didn't come out of a book. If you didn't have and go through what you went through, there's your gift. If you hadn't gone through what you went through, you would not have been able to relate to the people that you work with that you can help. So it's a very interesting thing what occurs. That hit, whatever that hit is this impetus and the stimulus and the wisdom, that's the right word, the wisdom to be able to do what you want to do.
Yeah, and I think that I am an example of some of the things that people choose to do when they have a functional midlife crisis, when we do this on purpose and we do it well, is to recognize that some of the most difficult things that they may have experienced in their life have given them gifts, and that in the time that they have left, one of the things that can, for many people, be most rewarding is figuring out a way to give those gifts back, either as a volunteer or a parent or a peer or as a business. And I really enjoy helping people go for what's juicy in their life.
Oh, yeah.
Because at the age of 50, you know what's juicy. You've been there, you've done that.
But that time, yeah.
You know what's stinky and you know what's juicy.
Oh, absolutely. Let's see, 13 years ago, I was diagnosed with stage 3B lung cancer. They gave me They gave me a year and a half to live with chemo, with radiation, and the rest of it, which I've never had any of it. And they said, you have cancer. The first thing out of my mouth, Dyke, was, how do you fix it? And they said, you're going to die. I said, guess again, pal. And I think really a lot of it is mindset. If you think it, and that's really where the transition comes. Before you go through the stuff, if you think you're going to be a particular way, guess what? That's what's going to happen. That's who you see in the mirror when you get up in the morning. But if you have to be forced to think a different way, or you decide to think a different way, that's how your life turns out. The world is nothing more than a mirror of what you think inside. And the people that are around you, the people you draw to you, are the people who will prove to you what you think about yourself, good, bad, or indifferent. That's how powerful we are. Somebody once said, how powerful are you? And I said, I'll tell you what, you want to find out, close your eyes, and the lights all over the world go out.
Yeah.
That's
well, and it's interesting, too, when you talk about how you talk to yourself and who you think you are, one of the things that has been a huge healing for me is, you know, the little voice that talks to you and maybe tries to get in your way when you're doing something new in your life, the little voice in the back of your head? I know a bunch of different people who I've worked with who teach you that little voice is your enemy and it's something to be ignored or acted in spite of. Overcome. And what I've found is that having an actual relationship with that little voice, because it's actually a protector and a valuable advisor, having a relationship with that voice so that all the parts of me, the conscious part of me that wants to move forward and the part that makes the little voice in the back of my head, so that we're all aligned in the direction we're headed, it sort of takes out that achievement pattern you see that people call one step forward, two steps back.
Sure.
It lets everything be smoothly moving in one direction. So that's one of the things I also have discovered, used myself, used with my coaching clients, and teach everybody right now, which is how to create that conscious relationship with the little voice that may have stopped you in the past. And that's one of the things I think that's kind of special about the way that I teach people to manage change.
You know what I found years ago? I found two little voices. The first little voice was that little monster you were talking about that says you can't, you're going to die, you're going to this, you're going to that. But then I learned over a period of time, if I got quiet, just got quiet for a little while, I didn't have to sit on a hill and meditate for 12 hours. But if I just got quiet for a little while and I didn't think ahead and I didn't think behind and I just concentrated on right now, this moment, the second, for as long as I could, which sometimes is maybe 4 seconds at the most, that's when that other little voice pops up. And that's the little voice that says you can do anything that you want to do. And I think for the most part, if you can get beyond that first voice and you get down to the true voice, the first voice is all of those people who have told you that you can't. And that's nothing more than an echo. And that other little voice is that voice inside of you that's who you really are that says, yes, you can. I'm right here. And all you have to do is get quiet for just a little bit of time. And I don't mean learn meditation processes. That's not where I'm at. Just 13 seconds of quiet, 10 seconds of quiet. And all of a sudden, you'll hear that voice.
Well, yes, and what I'll say is that little voice in some cases represents programming that somebody's told you in the past. But what I can tell you is that the way our nervous system is built, the little voice actually marks the boundaries of your comfort zone. Anytime you approach the boundaries of your comfort zone and begin to think about doing something new, especially putting a toe outside of your box, that little voice is going to kick off because it's a normal function of the human psyche. And when you explore the voices of your awareness, you'll find there's many more than two. And the challenge is a number of these are things that we're not conscious of. But that same voice is the voice that had you study before your exams when you were growing up, had you play your instrument before your concert. What it wants to know, it doesn't necessarily want to stop you from getting what you want. What it wants to know is that when you're outside your comfort zone, you'll be okay and you'll come back safe. So typically when you have a relationship with it, it has great advice. It makes okay. sure that you've got all the I's dotted and the T's crossed. And what it really wants is your attention. It doesn't want to be shut out of the boardroom.
Okay, let me hold you up. We're starting to run out of time, but let me end it with this. Let me speak your language for a minute, and I wish we had more time to do this. Listen to what you said, and let me give it back to you in a different way. Your first little voice comes from the central nervous system. The second little voice comes from the sympathetic nervous system, and the third little voice to protect you comes from the parasympathetic nervous system to balance you out. And with that, do you have a website we can find you at?
You bet. My training and coaching programs and my New Life Roadmap free report, which you can get for visiting the website, are all at my website, 3hourmidlifecrisis.com. You can either use the number 3 or spell out the word 3, 3hourmidlifecrisis.com. And what I can do for anybody who visits, just grab that free report, and it'll begin you on a path where I can show you exactly how to create a functional midlife crisis and use it as a shortcut to living the life you deserve. The website, again, is 3hourmidlifecrisis.com. And I'd love for you to head there, grab the free report.
Wonderful. I'll tell you what, this interview has been a lot of fun, and there's somebody going to get mad about the interview. It's going to be the guy I call tomorrow and say, cancel the red Ferrari.
Well, somebody told me I ought to have my training sponsored by a Ferrari dealership.
Hey, Doug, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mike Roy.
Take care. Good night.
All right, good night.
As you're filing out the door, as they say in this biz, that's all there is, there isn't any more. We've shared a moment, And as the moment ends,
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
I got a funny feeling we're parting out as friends. Your cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the